Good morning. Thanks for having me. First of all, let me congratulate you on 50 years. You don't look a day over 40. I also like to thank you very much for having me. Oh, hello. Thank you for having me over on the technical services side. Having spent a lot of time on reference, I hope you'll forgive me if I speak English. And thanks very much. I'm very appreciative, and I'm very glad I had a chance to come to this group in particular, because we've been working on some interesting things in how we can organize information, and I'd like coming to the experts to get feedback, advice, and get some really good ideas out on the table. But I'm going to start with the idea of how much trouble we're in, if you will, and talk about massive scale. And what do we mean by massive scale? Well, we came up with this phrase, massive scale, because we looked at the idea, we'll talk about some of it, computing getting bigger and bigger. And in the National Science Foundation, they like throwing, I think it's Greek, but it might be Latin, prefixes, on everything. And so we talked about gigascale computing and terascale computing. You'd be happy to know that we've now ended the terascale world and entered into the petascale computing world. And we figured we'd just cut to the chase, and we would just call it massive scale, because it's always going to get bigger. And we got tired of changing, you know, the letterhead. We originally called it N-scale until we realized that all the model train builders would be very upset at us. So we're in a massive scale world. What do we mean, what do I mean when I talk about massive scale? I want to give you one example. I was working with a group at the Transportation Research Board. And these are the folks who are part of departments of transportation in the states and federal. These are the people who put down your roads. And we were talking about how we can build better information systems and knowledge networks in this domain. And it began, as I'm sure a lot of meetings that you go to, it began as a set of libraries coming together and talking about how they could share library resources back and forth. And the fact that they have so many resources that aren't cataloged and things without extension, and can we get things in WorldCat? How can we build a consortium? Right? My favorite line about consortium is, to a vendor, three librarians in a bar is a consortium. Right? So we've got to have a consortium. And as we move through this process, I mean, this is sort of well-known steps we can go by to share information and make them available, but then we realize that, you know, we're really talking about the wrong thing. That the information sitting in those libraries and those books and those resources are only a small fraction of the information that transportation has to deal with. And, as we'll talk about towards the end, if these library communities only concentrate on what's in those buildings and ignore what's happening outside of those, they're going to become less and less relevant. But more than that, they're going to miss the opportunity to do what we really want to do, which is to serve and improve our organizations. And as we were talking about where this information is, we started using this phrase, gigabyte per mile. And that goes that soon, every mile of road in this country will generate a gigabyte of data a day. I want you to think about that for a minute. Right? And where, how? I mean, no one's typing on the roadway. But road sensors. What they talk about now is, we know that salt's bad. So the last thing we want to do is every time it gets low. Now, I'm from Syracuse, so we know a lot about salt. Right? The last thing, if it gets under 32 degrees, send out the trucks, throw salt everywhere. Well, the problem when you throw salt everywhere is that water then melts and goes into things and kills ducks and things, and so it's bad. So we don't want to do salt. So what do? Well, next time we pave the road, what we'll do is we'll embed these tiny little sensors that will transmit when they're frozen. So if there's been no rain or no moisture in the air and it's under 32 degrees, no big deal. It says, I'm fine. But the minute it says, no, there's moisture and I'm frozen, come salt me. We can decrease salt creation. Well, they're talking about embedded sensors everywhere. You've probably seen them if you come up to a stop sign or you come up to a stop light. You see these wonderful little etchings in the road. Usually they're squares, but sometimes they're circles, that say, oh, there's a car on me, I should switch to green, I should let people go. By the way, there's really interesting work on how that works, because if you get two cars that pull too close, it thinks that there's actually one big car there. Real-time traffic data, right? When you're, God help us, if we're in Washington, D.C., we need real-time traffic data. I don't want to wait for 10 after the hour to find out that I'm stuck. Right? I want to know right now, where's this traffic? And what's really interesting is now, we just bought a new Honda Odyssey. All I do is tell stories, by the way. But we bought this wonderful Honda Odyssey for my wife. I got the hand-me-down. That has a GPS system in it, and it's like, it's like driving the Starship Enterprise. You're just in this thing. It's like, oh, car 2.0. This is wonderful. It talks to me, and I talk to it. But that's more than you need to know. But what they're talking about is truly a wireless network. That putting wireless, not just Wi-Fi internet receivers into cars, but transmitters and hubs, so that as you're driving through a city, you're actually amplifying the signal to everyone else, creating a metropolitan area network. And what they're saying is we can track, privacy warnings here, we can track how fast the car is going. And so if we see that these 300 cars are going at 1 mile an hour, there's traffic there. And we can route people differently. So suddenly the cars are transmitting what's happening on the roads. Weather information. We need to know if it's raining, if it's cold. Toll data. In the Northeast Corridor, we have these things called Speed Pass or Easy Pass, where as you pass through them, it says, this is, this car gets charged X, so you don't have to stop. Well, that data has become amazingly useful. In fact, it's an unanticipated consequence. New York State is fending off thousands and thousands of requests for this data, primarily from divorce lawyers who want to know where someone was. Right? It was actually used in a rather serious case where at one point there was an assistant district attorney that went missing from court, and he was prosecuting a mob case. And when they went to look for him, and unfortunately they found his body, they found him based on what exit he went out last. So this data is being generated on a regular basis. Black boxes within the cars. It's assumed that this will become a gigabyte an hour. As there are 3.5 million miles of highway in the U.S., that would be 3.3 petabytes of data per hour, or 28 exabytes of data per year. What's an exabyte? Glad you asked. Well, we all know what a byte is. Well, a byte is a single character. If you get 1,024 of those, you get a kilobyte. That's basically a typewritten page. Then you move up to megabytes. 2 megabytes is a high-resolution photograph. You get 1,024 of those, you get a gigabyte. That's about 20 meters of shelved books. 1,024 gigabytes, you get a terabyte. That's all the academic research libraries. Now, I can buy a terabyte hard drive today for under $1,000. Within 2 years, you will buy a laptop with a terabyte hard drive in it. Right? I mean, you think you're running out of room with the pictures and the illegal music downloads now. You're not going to have any problems. Right? These are an exponential increase. After terabytes, we get to petabytes. All the U.S. academic research libraries. An exabyte, 5 exabytes would cover every word ever spoken by man, ever. And yes, there are exabyte hard drives out of that. Just in case you're curious, people stay awake late at night worrying about this. There is anticipated a zettabyte, and for those really having fun, a yodabyte. Store information, you will. Okay. Maybe not that yodabyte. It's a lot of stuff. What we're talking about is just the roads, just driving will generate exabytes of data. Just driving, that's just roads, that's the boring stuff of concrete. Forget the idea of satellite images, data gathering, real-time health information. Forget all that. We're talking about asphalt. What are we going to do about this? Now, people don't often, when you put this thing out, it doesn't necessarily become real. This is what's called an exponential increase, right? And we're not used to thinking exponentially. We're used to thinking linearly. And there was a good example that came out of Gladwell wrote The Tipping Point in this experiment. If you know the experiment, don't ruin it. Imagine that I give you a very, very, very large piece of paper, like the mall size. But it's a standard 1/100th of an inch thick. Now take that sucker and fold it in half. Now, originally I said fold it, and then some smartasses at Charleston said, well, what if I fold it in thirds? No, fold it in half. Right? Do that 50 times. Right? Fold, 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 50 times. How tall would that paper be when you're done? How thick? Guesses? We're not a big group. I can see you.
Three
An inch, right? Maybe someone brave thinking, oh, as big as a refrigerator. Approximately the distance between the Earth and the Sun. It's an exponential increase. What happens is when you fold it in half, you double its width. When you fold it, you don't just double its width, you actually double the doubling of the width. So you make it four times as thick. You do it again, it's 8, 16, 32, 64, and it goes nuts. When we talk about an exabyte, we are talking about an exponential increase over what we have now. It's not just bigger, it's a lot bigger. And every time we make that jump, we make it even bigger still. Now, what's interesting about this massive scale world is that it is a predictable change. This is something we know is going to happen. Unlike the web, massive scale computing is foreseeable. Right? We can make an argument that libraries took some time to figure out the web. And I would make an argument, by the way, that we have. That we've done a really good job of figuring out the web in terms of providing our services, providing as public services, incorporating into our own workflow. But it took us a while. And I don't think we can really stand back and, you know, really hurt ourselves that in 1992 we didn't say, aha, we will be booking flights through the web and I'll be running through, you know. No, it was weird. It was unpredictable change. It was a discordant change. But this massive scale world is not. We know it's coming. We know that they're going to get faster. You know the next laptop you get will be even faster than the previous one, even if you bought it last week. Right? There's this wonderful thing called Moore's Law, and some people will argue whether it's a law or not, but it says that computing power will double every 18 months, or the price will halve, but it never does. Right? If it doubles every 18 months, we are in the exponential world. It's not that it gets a little bit faster, it gets twice as faster, and then it gets twice as fast as that. And what's really scary is that we've been really good at Moore's Law. It's worked. It's the number of transistors we can put on them. And storage, the hard drives we have in the world, are exceeding Moore's Law. We're actually generating more data, more hard drive space than ever before. We know this is coming. What I want to talk about in the massive scale world is fact, not science fiction. So I apologize as I read this. Ask.com operations VP Dwayne Sampson estimates that the five leading search companies together, Google, Ask, all those folks, have 2 million servers, each shedding 300 watts of heat annually. This is not computing power. This is they get hot. This is what laptop burns your lap's heat. A total of 6,000 megawatts of heat. There are linked hard drives that dissipate another gigawatt, 50% again as much power is required to cool the searing heat, for a total of 2.4 gigawatts. With a third of the incoming power already lost to the grid's inefficiencies and half of what's left lost to power supplies, transformers, and converters, the total electricity consumed by major search engines in 2006 approaches 5 gigawatts. Almost enough to power Las Vegas on the hottest day of the year in heat. That's waste product. Right? We're to the point where when Ask.com wants to add more servers, they can't because the Washington, D.C. metropolitan area doesn't have enough power to give them. Google is building a data center in rural Oregon. Why? Because it's on the Colorado River next to a hydroelectric dam that can provide the power. We are in an exponential, massive scale world now. We are in the world of terabytes and petabytes and exabytes now. I just went to see Ocean's 13 and they were mentioning exabytes in the plot. It was really frightening. George Clooney, an exabyte. What are we doing here? This is what we're talking about. We're talking about data, right? We're talking about lots of data. When our folks at DSpace opened up DSpace and said, hand us your articles, all the MIT professors looked and said, no, here's a terabyte data set from a satellite that we're gathering. They didn't care about articles. They were just like, we're swimming in data. Help us. You probably have folks coming to you talking about institutional repository. Great idea. I have 50 million of something for you to deal with. Right? That's the world that we're in. What are our options to deal with it? Well, we can do my favorite option. We can ignore it. Right? Yeah, it doesn't bother us. Go ahead. You have your terabytes. We're fine. Right? The problem is if we ignore it, we will look at the increased commercialization of data stewardship. In essence, someone will fill this gap. And if it is not us, with the principles of librarianship, with the principles of data stewardship, with the principles of service, it will be someone else, and they will fill a market. Right? We've already seen the consequences of when large search engines gather this data, or God forbid, the telecommunications industry gather this data on usage. What can happen if they don't have such a principled view? So by ignoring it, we simply say we will shift this to someone else's problem, and those people may not have the good intentions, the history, the background that we do. We could see the dissolution of the library as an institution or continued reduction to a niche player. In essence, if we're dealing with terabytes and you're dealing with shelving, we'll go ahead without you. We've seen this already. We've seen it with disastrous consequence. When people look at the stereotypical library and they say, you're about books and high quality and pristine information, you can't handle our terabytes of data. If we don't stand up, if we don't be part of that, we will simply become that nice little quaint place in the corner. Now, I want to be careful. I don't want to get into the fear and loathing in library land talk, because that's not where we are. I just want to make it real clear what stakes we're talking about. We could limit the library. In other words, rather than looking at the library as an institution that provides information freely for all, we could look at the library as the high-quality parlor. We could say, that's terabytes, that's data. We don't do data, we do knowledge. We don't do bits and bytes, we do synthesis. We do the, right? We could do that. And by the way, I think we could do that and continue to be relevant and functional. But I think we also can be looking at a set of static resources to do that with. But it also, what's very interesting about the massive scale world is it brings directly into collision two principles that we have stated that are in contradiction. The library world has stated that we believe in intellectual freedom and access to all for all information. We said that. That's our job, right? At the same time, we have stated that we believe in selection. A lot of what we do is about selectivity and quality control. And we've always sort of justified those two arguments, access to everything and selecting from everything, by saying resources. We, in essence, don't have enough resources to access it all. We have to deal with a subset. Therefore, we'll select. Does that make sense? Doesn't to me either. But the idea that what we've said is we can't afford it all, we can't store it all, we can't connect it all, so therefore we have to pick. Well, what happens if you don't have to pick? What happens if I go and I say, you know that terabyte data set your faculty wants you to house? Here, $500, here's a terabyte hard drive for you to put it on. We don't have to pick. What happens if we have unlimited storage? What happens if we have unlimited computing capabilities? And we no longer can make the argument that we can't do it because we don't have the resources. What do we do then? What does it look like to collect it all? Well, we could catalog it all. That usually gets a laugh. But we tried it. Everyone remember Quark? Collaborative online resource cataloging, where we paid to do MARC records and websites. It's an interesting business model. Right? We could catalog it all. Ultimately, I argue that we need to embrace it. And I would also argue that it's the ethical responsibility of LIS education, putting myself on the spot here, that we must embrace it and teach our students to do it. You should be hiring Terascale librarians next year, because this is the world that we're in. And if we simply continue to believe that we only deal with the documented record and define that in a very narrow scope, we are doing a disservice to our profession. Our profession needs to own this space. Now, why can't we catalog at all? Why not? We're here. Well, first of all, the amount of digital is also, the amount of information we're talking about is growing exponentially. It doubles every 18 months, just like Moore's Law. And most of this information is digital. This argument that not everything's digitized, you're right, not everything's digitized. And there's some amazing, precious, wonderful, important, need-to-keep resources that aren't and may never be digital. But the vast majority of new information being produced today is. And what's amazing is the size and scale of that information dwarfs all the information that's not digital. And what's also very interesting is that more and more of this information being generated is not text. And this scares me to no end. If you look at information retrieval, if you look at our tools, if you look at how our catalogs are built, if you look at library systems, and by the way, Google, if you look at the search engines, they assume text. They're built on text. We know how to deal with text. We don't know anything about a video. If we do pictures, I love this. Google came out with pictures, and the way they decided to catalog pictures was they made it into a game. So they put a picture up, two
people went head to head, two people enter, one person leaves. The Thunderdome of images.
And they kept throwing tags, and the idea was to see how many of those agreed. But what they were doing is collecting the tags and using it for their indexing data. This is not a long-term solution. Right? What do you do about a YouTube video? God, I love YouTube. If anyone ever invented a better way to waste your life, YouTube is it. Right? What do we do with the videos that are up there? Less and less of it's text. Also, what do we do with things that simply don't work in traditional cataloging? Now, living documents and wikis, those are easy, right? They change from day to day. When do you freeze it? When do you put the record on it? How do you mark it? Right? And wikis, cool, new, not very cool, new, but, you know, wikis are the fancy way. Living documents, what do we do with Congressional Research Service open brief documents? What do we do with revisions? But I want to get to the really cool ones. What do we do with things that really don't work with traditional cataloging? Gigapixel images. If you bought a digital camera recently, you probably had a top-end choice of about 12 megapixels for a lot of money, and about 7 megapixels if you wanted a short snap. Exponential increase. People are working on gigapixel images. Once again, an order of magnitude larger than the camera in your hand. It would take a video wall of 10,000 television screens or 600 prints from a professional digital SLR camera to capture as much information as contained in a single gigapixel exposure. What does that mean for you? Let's take just a really bad simulation. Here's a gigapixel image of Times Square. Oh, ooh-ah, we know how to do that. We can catalog it. But here's the trick with a gigapixel image. Let's zoom in. We can take any part of it and zoom in. And then we can say, well, what's it there in the lower left-hand corner? Zoom in. And now we can read it. Or what's in the upper corner? Oh, there's that. Imagine taking a gigapixel image of a stadium, a baseball stadium, where you can zoom in on every face in the crowd in the stadium. How do you catalog that? Is that one record? Is that a billion records? What is the information when the actual diving into this image changes its very nature? Are you using this to get a large-scale impression? Are you using this to get a micro-scale impression? These things don't yield themselves to traditional, it's a picture, we'll deal with it as a picture, because they contain so much information that if we don't make it accessible, we have a problem. So, I put out a call for help. What we need to do is we need to expand and enhance current library practice to deal with this. We need to go beyond a focus on artifacts and items. Looking at that image and saying it is a photograph is unhelpful. It is a information retrieval tool. It's a system. It's a book of information just done in visual form. We need to see richness beyond the structure of metadata. And this is really important. I used to talk about the revenge of the librarian. Right? Revenge of the librarian was we were always invited to the third meeting. You guys ever do this? Right? So the first meeting is a bunch of people get together and says, we've got a bunch of stuff we want to share. The second meeting is like, well, if we're going to share it, maybe we should, I don't know, call it all the same thing. Who's done this before? Third meeting, they bring us in. Right? Third meeting, oh, I guess the librarians can help us after all. And we, yay! You know, it's like, and not a little bit of told you so. Right? The problem is, what we did is I'm very much to blame for this. What we did is we said, no, what you need to do is come up with a metadata schema. The metadata schema has to have a one-to-one relationship where we have multiple tags, and we're going to need to qualify those tags, and then we need a controlled vocabulary. I'm just suggesting a taxonomy because an ontology is too much. But if we had an ontology that we could work out this information, then we can literate war, mark record, catalog, sharing, boom. And they all looked at us like, shit. Pardon my language. You guys must know what you're talking about. But the problem is what we were doing is driving them to one conversation too soon. And so what happened was they didn't have there was no literary warrant equivalent in their world because it was too formative. And so rather than figure out how we could take care of this rich mess that they had, we tried to eliminate the mess. I think of it as, imagine if you're trying to listen to conversations, and imagine two ways. One, you walk into Grand Central Station at rush hour, and you're trying to listen to conversations. You catch a word or two, but it's just too noisy and too busy. So what you do is you stand up and you say, all right, Business conversations on this half, personal conversations on this half. All right, law, medical, wait, what other Dewey classes do it, right? And we separate them out. And it's a brilliant way of taking all these multiple voices and segmenting them so we can pay attention to each. Now think of a different way of doing it. Think about radio, going back to old style technology. Right now, as you sit here, there are probably 60 or 70 different radio channels coursing through your body. Through FM transmitters, AM transmitters, satellite transmitters, you have millions of conversations going through your body right now. But they don't get in the way. They're not. You don't have to segment them and stop some of them. What you do is you get this piece of technology called a tuner, and you pick which ones you want, and you can filter out the rest. And what's nice is if you find one conversation here on the spectrum and one on the spectrum, with presets you can put them right next to each other. This is a different way of thinking about organizing information. Rather than reducing noise in the catalog, in fact, you increase noise in the catalog and you build really good tuning tools. So when we thought about this, we came up with this concept of participatory librarianship, and we wrote a technology brief for ALA. ALA came to us and said, the federal government is talking about expanding SEPA with something called DOPA. Never a better name for a law ever. Defense of Online Predators Act. And what they're saying is, as we know, MySpace is just there for pedophiles, and so therefore we need to filter it from our schools to save them from themselves. The problem was that when they got to defining things, they couldn't write into a piece of legislation, MySpace. It's not nice to take on a company and just make them illegal through a stroke of the pen. So they tried to come up with a definition of social networking, and they couldn't. They tried things like interactive website. Interactive website, does that mean entering a form? Does that mean that, you know, everything's now illegal? Or it has to be filtered? They said, don't worry about it. What we'll do is we'll form a committee after the law is passed, and they'll tell us what we have to filter. Committee on Un-American Acts or something. Right? But the thing is, we can all go, rrr. We also found that library administrators and librarians were having the same problem, which is when they were dealing with social networking or when they were hearing Library 2.0 or Web 2.0, they were hearing these words, but when they tried to push on them, they couldn't define them very well. And so they said, Information Institute, come up with a nice paper, technology brief on what is this social networking thing. And as we looked at it, we started with Everyone Starts, which is the bad dictionary. Mashup is this. This is that. Flickr is that. And we realized that other people had done it much better than ours. And also, it was a very feature-centric view. What we were doing is defining a bunch of things we could do, not why we could do them or how they held together or what they could do for us. And so we looked for something that was durable underneath, and we ended up with something called conversation theory. And conversation theory is a theory of learning, which is, think about people coming to your library as learners. When they're trying to access information, they're trying to learn something. And so we instantly look in the domain of learning. And it's and this fellow by the name of Gordon Pass said, learning, knowledge, is a conversation. We acquire knowledge through conversation. Sometimes that conversation is one-to-one, one-to-many, many-to-many. Sometimes it's internal. If you're into in library instruction, you've heard of things like metacognition or critical thinking, thinking about yourself thinking. Right? And this is the idea that you're actually having a conversation with yourself about this. Do I believe it? Don't I believe it? Well, does that work with this? And what you're doing is coming up with agreements, and those agreements become the foundation of knowledge. If libraries are in the knowledge business, we're in the conversation business. Books, videos, web pages are artifacts. They're a pale afterglow of knowledge. Knowledge occurs as a dynamic, interesting, interactive process of which we then document it. Those documents are important and useful, but a pale afterglow of what we really want to get to with is knowledge. So the question is, how can we replace a focus on these artifacts, these things, these dying embers of human contact, and focus it on the conversation and knowledge creation act itself? Technology enables us to do it, but this is not a technology-only problem. So conversation should also be two ways. What I want to do is I want to walk you through a couple of examples of what a participatory system looks like. And I want to start with a non-participatory system. I'm a trustee, so I can pick on these folks. But you will notice that it doesn't look radically different than most other libraries, right? So the first thing is I'm going to find a book. I want to read Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone because everyone does. So I come here, and the first thing I have to figure out is, where do I go? Well, clearly I go to the place where I order sweaters for Christmas called a catalog, and I end up here. Now I get to search the catalog or search the digital catalog. A catalog of fingers. Nope, I'll just search the regular one, and we end up here, right? So we put in Harry Potter, and we end up here. And of course, the first thing that comes up is the magic of Harry Potter, and the second thing is Lego Creator. That makes so much sense. Right? Now, some of you will jump to tell me why that is, but let me help you, right? One is, this system happens to present first in, last out. It's always great to present search results by the time catalogers got the materials. Secondly, as we all know with metadata, we have a problem, which is when you're describing Harry Potter, you don't actually use the keywords Harry Potter that often. It's about a boy wizard. It's about this. But when you're talking about J.K. Rowling or something, you use Harry Potter a lot. So therefore, the richness of key text will bring us to the not right item to begin with. But let's go to that. We'll go to our second page. And there we go, the third result on the second page. And up comes the resource. And if we scroll down, we can even see where that resource is. By the way, don't even get me started on the wonderful graph view on the side. Let's compare this to another system, Amazon. Oh, no, don't pick on us, not Amazon. Yes, Amazon. All right, I'm willing to admit it in public. You don't have to raise your hand. How many people go to Amazon to find the book and then take the ISBN number and take it back to New York Catalog? All right. Why is that? Well, first of all, let's start with a Harry Potter search. And what I find interesting is the first result is actually a book that hasn't been published yet. But let's keep going. And if we scroll down on the same page, we'll find Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone, and if we bring it up, we get this kind of information about it. Now, what I want to think about is, why is it that it's easier to find something for many cases in Amazon than it is in our catalogs? Is it, many people look at this and say, what we need to do is make our catalogs look more like Amazon.com, but they often say it the wrong way. We need to make it simpler. We need to make it more dynamic. We need prettier pictures on it. We need tags. God knows, tags will help us. What I want to show you is an example. Here is the complete bibliographic record for Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone from WorldCat. I know you can't read it. This is the same record. This is what we just looked at for Onondaga County Public Library. Complete, this is a screen dump of the entire page. National Library of Australia. Why not? I'm always looking for an invitation back to Australia. Library of Congress. Everyone ready? Here comes Amazon. Oh, no. What is that? Clearly, they have really good catalogers, right? Well, let's break it down. Clearly, it's all sales information, right? Well, the top, that little itty-bitty blue band, is the branding information of Amazon. The next is the sales information, which you can really argue is a form of bibliographic data. Under that, we have recommendations based on sales. Then we have quality reviews. Quality reviews are New York Times book review, these kinds of things. Then we finally have bibliographic data. That orange band is the bibliographic data, and you'll notice it's not out of whack with the other ones generated by the library world. So what else is going on here? Recommendations based on previous purchases, open reviews, reviews from people who have read it, pathfinders. Remember we did pathfinders? Discussion tools, and finally at the end, some additional marketing information. This is conversational data. This is data about conversations, right? This is data about participation, about the use of an item, right? So what we can do is if we look for a minute and we say this column here is sort of our traditional systems. Our traditional systems, we have things like virtual reference and traditional reference, bibliographic catalogs, recommender systems, and databases. We've realized that from that first example of OCPL, it's too discordant. We haven't integrated it. As a library profession, we're so dedicated to increasing and improving service that we jump ahead on new systems, and we don't always take the time to integrate them back in, right? So what we've already started doing as a library profession is we've begun integrating, right? So federated searching. Why do I have to search the catalog and then search the databases and then search Google? That doesn't make sense. Let's do it through federated searching. With reference, we have traditional reference and virtual reference. Why are these separate data sets? We should put them together. Knowledge bases. We recommend your systems. And you're already seeing things in this bottom about Ann Arbor Public Library, for example, where you can integrate tags, but it's still very item specific. And we can anticipate that there's going to be another wave of integration, where we have the community repository, the data generated by our institutions and ourselves, by blogs and wikis that we host, content, or a really horrible and less useful phrase, full text. And at the bottom, we have the enhanced bibliographic data. So not only do we have the bibliographic data, but now we have use systems, so that when we pop up results, maybe what we do is pop up the most popular item instead of the last one cataloged. Right? So we can anticipate these two even merging into something that we call a participatory library system. Why is it that we anticipate our users coming into our systems to navigate this interesting domain? Right? What we have are catalogs. Think about them for a minute. We like to think of our catalogs as finding aids. They are not. They're inventory systems. They're inventory systems. Now, an inventory system in retail is what happens when you go to buy shoes. And you say, do you have that in a size 10? It's what the person does, it's what the salesperson does. They walk away from you, behind a computer screen that you can't see, input obscure text, come back and say, yes, I'll go get it for you. They don't let the patron see it. What do? We turn around and say, good luck. Go search the warehouse. Right? Why is it that we have all of that? It's on the third floor, it's on the fifth floor, because it helps people find it. Yeah, but it doesn't help them find it. No one searches by fifth floor. Rarely do they have to search by fifth floor. Right? What they're doing is we're taking an inventory, which is important and useful for us as people operating a facility, and we're assuming it's sufficient as a finding aid for our users. And it is not. Amazon has an inventory system. You don't see it. When you order the book, it kicks in. Right? Now, we have examples of how we, in library land, use conversational data currently. Citations in scholarly communications. Right? Why is it that Web of Science makes so much sense? And why do scholars use it? Because we see scholarly communication as a conversation. Joan Bechtel wrote about this in the 80s. When we do library instruction, we need to teach people not bibliographic instruction, but as a conversation. Right? Following citations back and forth. And yet what's interesting is when we take an article full of citations and we put it in our catalogs, we ignore the citation, the conversational data, and we put the front matter in, the item data. So we make it very easy to find the item and almost impossible to find out what that item belongs to. As collection developers, this must drive you nuts. To have a beautiful collection development policy where you spend time, effort to create a coherent collection development policy that has coherence, you understand why these items are related, it goes into a catalog and we rip it apart. And we only let you find the items within it. We see this in law, in the form of precedents. When you search for law, you don't search for items, you search for what cited what. What's the precedent behind this, and you track it. But we also see in library land through bibliometrics, the Invisible College, Web of Science, Special Collections and Collection Development understands conversational. It's there, we just need to expose it. So let me give you an example of how we can begin to capture it. Let's say we have a user and a librarian, and the user comes to the librarian and asks, did it rain June 18th in Yellowstone National Park? And the reference librarian says, yep. Actually, it'd be nice if the reference librarian said yes. Normally what they do is they will take them to a book about Yellowstone, but right, the user comes back and they ask a question, which is, how sure are you that it rained? Now, the minute you ask this question, it gets a little bit more interesting, right? Because now what happens is, well, I found out it rained because I went to this weather model. Because we don't actually have pictures of it raining in this obscure world part. So I went to this weather model, and it said there's a 98% chance that it rained on June 18th. Well, that model itself is based in a series of algorithms and mathematical manipulations. That mathematical manipulation comes from a variety of sources such as weather balloons, satellite data, and atmospheric data or controls around. And that algorithm is also created by a series of researchers. All right? Now, what's interesting is if you were to look at each one of those boxes, would they all show up in the same place in your library? And yet they're related. Now you say, Dave, they're related to this one patron. What about the other 50 patrons? I would argue that that one patron should be able to see it this way. The 58 should be able to see it 50 different ways. But what's also interesting is we now have related to Yellowstone, this question we have related to terabytes and terabytes of data. In other words, that data coming in from satellites and such, we're back in exabyte territory. And now we didn't catalog an exabyte data set. We know that for this question, this exabyte data set is useful. Now, why did this person ask this question? Well, maybe he's a lawyer and he's going into court to work on a claims case. Someone crashed. They said it was because it was raining and the insurance company didn't believe them. And so they're looking for the data taken to court. Now we've linked a court case and insurance to terabytes of data. This connection between this thing is not going to be exposed if we deal with these as individual atoms and artifacts, and yet it becomes very obvious if we look at it from a conversational standpoint. What we must begin to do is think in threads. And fervor, that deals with sort of different instantiations of the same artifact, but it's still very artifact-centric. What we want to do is we want to build into systems the ability to keep these threads, to have conversations. So let me give you an example. This is, I'll pick on another one for myself. We had some folks come to us from the library and said, we don't like our reserves system. Think about how we can improve it. And so we looked, so the reserve system, you go to find a reserve, you put in your instructor, your department, and you end up with a big list of stuff that you need to read for that section. It works. What's the big deal? Well, we wanted, they came to us because they wanted it to be more snazzy. They didn't necessarily want it to be more functional, but they definitely wanted it to be more snazzy. And so we went through a couple of iterations thinking about this. The first thing we said is, why in the world does a patron have to come in and tell you what class they want? We pay Syracuse University a lot of money to know what I'm taking. It should know automatically. Right? So now we have a patron who comes in, and it says, here you go, here's your information. And it breaks it up like, here are your articles, here are your books, here are your classes. Because it's Web 2.0, it's got to have my friends at the end. And within each individual one, we have the PDF file, and there is the bibliographic data in yellow. We have to have a cloud tag. You've got to have a cloud tag. If you don't have a cloud tag, you're just so unhip, I can't tell you. Get my cloud tag on the outside of my VW Beetle. Click a librarian. It was very important to them that they could get to the librarian, the content expert. I thought that was a very good idea. The social information, which we just stole from library thing because it's too cool. We can say 58 other people are reading this item or using this item, and you can do notes and annotate it. And then at the bottom, we threw in the Amazon data if you want to order it, because that's a mashup and mashups are cool. This is, if you look at Web 2.0 or Library 2.0, a functional view, this is a 2.0 application. And we should all be excited and go like this. But then we thought about it for a minute. We said, here's the problem. If I'm taking a class, why do I care if it's an article or if it's a book? Why do I care if it's something in the library or not in the library? Why do I care? How do I break this up? Who chose feeds versus this? In essence, what we need is a system that captures a conversation. And there's no more obvious example of a conversation in academia than a course. Right? An instructor has taken the time to put together a bunch of resources and thoughts and told us how they're linked. So now what happens is when you log in, it says, here are your conversations. Maybe a conversation's about a class. Maybe it's your great novel. Maybe it's how I'm going to get home for the weekend. Doesn't matter. You're having a conversation. We want to support a conversation. Not a conversation of the library, but a conversation of a patron. And so there's our syllabus in the upper left. And that syllabus points to a bunch of resources that we can look at. And now we know they're related. So if you went to the catalog and you type that book, you could then get the data back out to say, by the way, this book is used in these classes. And then, well, you know, when I was reading the syllabus, I had to do a term paper. And that term paper was something, an image. So I went and picked the image, so that's linked along the top. And when I looked at that image, it made me think about asking the author, the photographer, a question. So I sent them an email, and we got an email response. So now what happens is I have a conversation going. Some of those are library resources, some of those are personal resources, some of them are uploaded. But when I come to here, the resources make sense to me. And they're annotated so I know why. Right? This is why I have problems with folksonomies and tagging. I love tag clouds, I hate tags. Because a tag is when I look at something, I throw uncontrolled keywords at it. The evil part is not that it's uncontrolled. It's the fact that if you come back in a year and you look at those keywords, would you understand why you put those keywords with that image? It's like doing a literature review where you just list a bunch of books and you don't pay attention to why those books are there. You need an annotated bibliography. We know this. Why don't we make it available online? Right? And so now not only do I have these conversations, but when I ask that question, when I ask the librarian, I can push not only my question, but I can say, look, if I'm willing to share, Here's the structure that your answer is going to go in. That tells me what you've already looked at. It tells me the idea. It puts context around it. When I pick one of those resources, then up pops the delightful Library 2.0 thing. This is where it makes sense. Lots of good metadata I can use, but now I know why I'm looking at that item. Right? Now I have a bunch of conversations, so as I add different nodes, a URL, a Google search, an item, a book, something from the catalog, I can annotate it and say why it's here. And what we realized as we were doing it is this gives us the ability to migrate from static item-based stuff over to conversational data. Imagine now thinking threads. Imagine that you can now go surf your catalog. You can go through your catalog and you can surf it. So now you can say, well, here's the paper, I'm reading what I thought about it. But here's what other people thought about that paper. And did you know that this paper is also used in another class in another department? Have you ever thought about taking that one? And you end up with these really intricate threads that you can surf. Now, I don't want to get too techy here. But actually, if you look at this diagram, and this is nodes and edges. It comes from graph theory, which says when you go to a GPS system, you say, I want to go from here to here, Washington to Roanoke, every intersection you drive through is a node. And the edges are the roads that connect them. And so when you say get from here to here, what it does is it follows those nodes and finds you the shortest path. Well, imagine connecting everyone's conversations this way and say, get me from this idea to this idea in the shortest path. And I'll give you a quick example. I've got this down to about a minute. James Burke, one of my favorite historian broadcasters from England, he wrote The Day the Universe Changed and Connections, had a really great example of a nonlinear way of looking at history. And he said, the North winning the U.S. Civil War led to the modern computer revolution. Ready? The North should have lost the Civil War because the South had more troops. And the common thought at the time was that more troops on the ground meant you won. South had more men. But the North had all the industrial complex and could generate more artillery. The problem with artillery is you can't just point at the bad guy and shoot. It goes through a ballistic system, so you have to understand the area under the arc, which is calculus. The average Union soldier couldn't do much calculus on the fly, so what they did is when they generated the ballistic characteristics of an item, they gathered a bunch of mathematicians in the room that would come up with a table. The table would say, if the troops are this distance, put it at this angle and shoot. These people were called computers. As this winning of the Civil War changed the idea of the way you win wars by manpower turned into artillery. So during World War I and World War II, the goal was to generate more and more artillery, particularly against Germany that had a great military industrial complex and could generate them rapidly. As the U.S. would generate more and more artillery more and more often, they needed more and more of these tables to make them available, but they ran out of people. And so what they began to do was think, is there an automatic way to generate these tables? And so they looked at a binary computer, which they generated with ENIAC, and it was run with vacuum tubes. The problem with vacuum tubes is they're fragile, and they blow out a lot, particularly with insects come in, they blow up, that's what we call bugs. And so we had to replace the vacuum tubes. We realized that if we wafer silicon together, it becomes a semiconductor, we call those transistors. And transistors are great because we can shrink them smaller and smaller and smaller, and eventually put millions and millions on a chip. That chip is now called the CPU, and therefore the modern computer revolution. Therefore, the North winning the Civil War led to the modern computer revolution. Thank you very much. That's not a linear view, right? But it's interesting. And imagine if you could go into your catalogs and say, you know, given this wacky idea, how do you connect these two wacky ideas? What a great concept. The ability to generate new and novel knowledge by following, tracing, running through people's information. This is what collection development gets great about, right? They've got this article. This article came from this item. This item came from this item. And you build these wonderful trees and lattices in our libraries. Our libraries are not just collections of stuff. They're collections of conversations. Imagine when you think everyone here has a story where you touch someone's life and you improve someone's life through librarianship, and it started with a conversation. Why don't our systems show that? Why is it when people walk into our libraries, they see our books and edifices and not the true power, which is the knowledge and conversations and incredible people we have behind it? So, recommendations. First of all, libraries must be active participants in this. We must figure out this conversation thing. And we must do it at the core of librarianship. If you are in a speech that tells you to go blog, a librarian blogging about librarianship will bring not one more patron into your library. I'm a blogger, and I'm willing to say it. Don't do it, assuming that. I love blogs. I think blogs have a purpose. But I'm telling you, when we put blogs and wikis on top of catalogs and on top of this, and tomorrow it will be Twitters, and tomorrow it'll be QYs, and then it'll be mobile phones. If we keep stacking this stuff on top of existing systems, we will be crushed under the weight of our own systems. We must innovate and integrate these ideas at the core. Anything less simply adds stress. We must take our catalogs and tear them down. We must replace them with conversational systems that expose our brilliance. Ultimately, to ignore the implications of massive scale computing is dangerous. It abdicates serious decisions and consequences to others. If we let other people deal with these types of issues and these types of data sets, not only do we worry about becoming obsolete, I don't think we will, but we do worry about what they will do with the data. And we've already seen in a policy environment such as this, in a political environment such as this, in a commercial environment such as this, what happens if we don't step up to the bat? If we're not at the table talking about what fair use is and patron rights and principles, then someone else will do them without the principles, and it will create a worse society that we're in. Participatory librarianship is an opportunity not only to enhance what we do, but proactively position us at the forefront of the field where we belong. If we do not step up to the bat, if we do not say, this is our problem, if we do not say, we are part of the knowledge economy and knowledge creation, then we will become quaint, and I don't think useless, and I don't think gone, but I think much less important than we could be. If we simply worry about cataloging the world and don't worry about accessing the world, if we focus on the artifacts and things and not the knowledge and the conversations, we become increasingly reliant upon dead knowledge. We become adjunct to a knowledge creation facility, and ultimately that's our job. What I task you with, what I ask for your help, your input, and your insights are to make librarianship about knowledge truly, and to make it central, a connective tissue in the society that we have. Thank you very much for your time.